Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season 6 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kinds of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And, as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we're delving into the lavender haze of Australian history with queer historian Danielle Scrimshaw. Danielle is a writer, historian and lighthouse enthusiast who was born in 1997, the year that Tasmania became the last Australian state to decriminalise homosexuality. Over recent years, her work has been recognised by the Deakin Nonfiction Prize, the Australian Queer Archives and 40 South magazine. Danielle's first book, She and Her Pretty Friend, The Hidden History of Australian Women Who Love Women, was published by Ultimo in 2023 and emerged from her University of Melbourne honours thesis on queer history. According to Professor Joy DeMoussi, She and Her Pretty Friend is, quote, a pioneering and indispensable study of queer histories. The book has also been described as, quote, a historical rescue operation that makes visible some of the many queer women who've been written out of history. Danielle, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Danielle, it's no mean feat to develop an honours thesis into a book. It's pretty impressive. I've worked out that you were in your early 20s when you started working on this project.
Yeah,
and you're
right.
Still not yet 30, which means I think you take the title of our youngest guest so far in Archive Ooh. Fever. Congratulations. This all suggests that you developed the fever at an early age. Can you tell us how you first got the research bug?
I wasn't always planning to study history at university. I've always wanted to be a writer from a very young age, about 11 or 12, I started wanting to be an author, particularly of novels, basically. And I was writing all of these like fantasy and sci-fi stories in my teenage years. And it was only really in my VCE year levels, so 11 and 12 at the end of high school, that I started to become interested in history because I really liked my history teacher. I find it's the teacher can really like impact a student's kind of direction in life if they're really engaging. And I had a really great teacher in my VCE years. We did Australian history in year 12 and I was amongst my peers like, oh, but Australian history is so boring, which is still, I think, kind of the case. People have this general idea that Australian history is quite boring and maybe people need to address that because it's not boring. And I found that in my last year at high school that it wasn't boring. And I was like, oh, I kind of want to continue studying this when I go to uni. So I did a double degree in history and creative writing. While I was at university, I also discovered that I was queer and I came out as bisexual. So naturally, I was kind of drawn to researching queer histories, particularly within Australia, because I found that that was sort of my country of interest. So I was studying Australian history and found that there wasn't a huge publication record of queer history within Australia, definitely in comparison to the US and the UK. Obviously, there's been a lot of historians who have written about the topic of queer history in Australia, but I found that it was mostly behind a paywall, or I only had access to it because I was a university student, so I had access to Melbourne Uni's libraries and was able to access all the journal articles from like the early 2000s and everything that I wouldn't have been able to access it if I hadn't attended university and didn't study it at university.
Now, on this podcast, we often talk about, you know, like what it feels like to be in the grip of archive fever, the sort of rush of excitement and the sort of thrill of the chase of hunting down sources. And reading your book, I was really struck by the way in which that kind of research fever for you seemed to be entwined with a kind of romantic fever. Like there's a number of scenes, you know, of you for instance, kissing your girlfriend in the library while you're doing research, or going to, you know, visit the grave of another historical character with someone else you're kind of romantically involved in.
Yeah.
And I was sort of intrigued by those kind of two forms of fever kind of intermingling. Do you think there's something going on there for you? Like, are they connected?
Yeah, definitely. Looking back in hindsight, because as I said, I was coming out during uni and I was also researching these queer stories from the past, or potentially queer stories. My own like coming of age queer story was running parallel to these histories that I was reading about. And even at the time, I couldn't help but like make comparisons between like myself and some of the women I was writing about, which I think is why since the book has come out, people have been like, who's your favorite woman within the book? And it's always Lesbia Harford, the socialist poet who wrote really beautiful poetry and also pining poems about Katie Lush, her friend and philosophy tutor at Melbourne Uni. So I think the creative and the romantic brain of mine was just making those parallels.
We might have to rebrand the podcast Archive Lust rather than Archive Fever.
Yeah. Not such a strict allusion to Derrida, but perhaps we'll get bigger audiences.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
we might have to. Erotica set in archives.
To change our rating.
Yeah.
Somewhere. Danny, do you think it's true to say that you wrote the book that you wanted to read that you weren't able to find on the shelves at the time?
I think that's really true. Because when I was researching for my honours thesis, I was getting frustrated because it wasn't easy. When you are researching, you don't want it to be necessarily easy. I think part of archive research is the challenge and hunting down information. For queer women's history in Australia, it was just kind of all over the place. So like I said, it was journal articles and it was book chapters and everything. And there were published books about queer history in Australia, but there was only like one chapter about lesbians and it was like a few pages long and that was kind of it. And I noticed that there wasn't really just one book that was just exclusively about the queer woman's experience within Australia. So around like 2018, when I was thinking about my honours thesis, I told my friend, I want to write Australia's first like queer women's history. I guess that was kind of my plan when I was doing the thesis, because the thesis was structured as one chapter each. So it was like one mini biography. And those biographies have been included in the book, obviously rewritten because it's not as academic and I threw my own little creative touch to it. But yeah, it's kind of like an extension in that way of the thesis.
Yeah, it's not academic at all, by which I mean it wears its scholarship very lightly and is clearly written for a general readership.
Yeah.
So you've kind of done a public service for a lot of people who, as you say, might not ever go to university but might be looking for a book to pick up and see themselves reflected in.
And I've received so many messages from people like on social media about that too, about how they never would have picked up a history book but they found this at the bookstore or heard about it from a friend. I think that's another important thing was to make it accessible for people because, again, a lot of like academic books aren't very easy for people to come across. They're not easily accessible in a public library. You wouldn't find it on a regular bookshelf. So it was really important to me that it wasn't just for an academic audience. It was for anyone to read.
Well, you've certainly succeeded then because it's a great read.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Danny, throughout the book, you're quite critical of earlier generations of historians who've been kind of reluctant to see the possibility of queerness in the past. You know, as you note, there's been this tendency to sort of come across to women who had a very close bond through their life and say, oh, they were just close friends or they were roommates, or, you know, dismiss it in some way.
Yeah.
And you really kind of push back against those readings and argue in favour of, you know, seeing the possibility of queerness and speculating about, you know, what could have been.
Mm.
Can you talk to us about your method in that way? Like, why did you kind of really latch on to kind of speculation as method?
Yeah. Well, I think because reading people's arguments about why they were perceiving these relationships as heterosexual were almost hypocritical, because they were saying, well, there's no evidence to suggest that they were in a queer relationship. There's no evidence that they had sexual contact or anything. So from my perspective, I was like, well, then there's no evidence to suggest that they were heterosexual or even cisgendered and things like that. So I was just kind of coming across it from the other way and saying, well, from my own queer perspective, I'm going to assume that there is a possibility that these people might have had a queer relationship, especially when you are looking at women who spent years together, decades together, living together and are buried together and had such a loyalty to one another that it almost seems like it was a relationship, even if there wasn't any sexual contact, which a lot of researchers seem to deem so important, whereas there's so many ways to have a relationship, whether straight or queer, and I don't think the sexual contact was necessarily important. It could be exciting if you come across it in the archive, but I don't think it was my definition of a queer relationship. So when I was reading about these women, I was like, let's just be more open-minded about it, about the possibility that they might have had real romantic affection for one another.
Are there clues that you would look for in the archives that you might be able to offer our listeners, particularly a generation like my own? I'm 55, so you were born the same year as my eldest child. And so a way of looking at archives that might show me a path to a potentially queer life that I wouldn't see. So this is kind of a queer eye for the straight historian.
I almost wish it was that easy. And I do try and write about that at the end of the book and was just like, oh, here's a potential checklist. And then in the book I say, even if they check all those boxes, you're not just going to receive this evidence from anywhere. There's going to be just people in the past who you'll never be able to know for sure. Some of the women in the book, I can't claim with 100% certainty that they are queer. That's kind of why I went about the possibility for a queer relationship or a queer person. And I suppose some of the things that I was looking at and some of the things that the women shared in common were kind of like their refusal to marriage. And these were quite wealthy or middle class white women as well. They would have had opportunity to marry. Some of them were quite young, but there was, and I'm sure that there would have been offers for people like Anne Drysdale. She might have been a bit older because she came to Australia when she was in her 40s.
Vida Goldstein turned down Monash's proposal of marriage.
Exactly. And someone like Vida Goldstein and a lot of other women's advocates at that time said that they didn't want to pursue marriage because they were pursuing women's rights and they wanted to dedicate their lives to women's rights. I wouldn't point at that and say, well, that proves that she was a lesbian, because there would have been suffragists at the time who just wanted to advocate for their fellow woman and everything and weren't interested in marriage. But I think so many women's experiences of that, I wouldn't shut down that possibility that one of them might have been queer. And speaking of suffragists, because one of them that I wrote about was Cecilia John, who was friends with Vida Goldstein and then later moved to Europe, and she had a career in Eurythmics, which was this sort of interpretive dance thing. So she had a long-term relationship when she moved overseas, and she was buried with another woman and dedicated her life to women's rights and everything and never married. You kind of think, well, was there a particular reason why she didn't pursue any relationships with men?
Do you reckon that lesbian history is almost kind of anti-archival? And that's the sort of feeling that I picked up, not a hostility towards the archives so much, but that you are, in a way, working against the archive.
I don't think I was working against the archive, but I was curious about the absence of particular archives. With some particular queer historical figures, there's these stories of, oh, well, their family burnt all their diaries and letters after they died. I think what's the famous American poet, Emily?
Dickinson,
yeah. I read somewhere that her family burnt a lot of her personal records after she passed to, quote unquote, protect her identity. So when I kind of encountered stories of missing journals or just absent papers in the women that I was researching, it made me very curious. It might not lead to anything, but I'm just kind of someone who was as literate and academic as Katie Lush, who was working at Melbourne University and in these very middle class socialist circles and would have written lots of letters and everything. I couldn't find any of her papers. And I can only assume that there might be some letters in like the Nettie Palmer collection, because she was in like a similar circle to Nettie Palmer, the writer. But I feel like when the person themselves feels so ordinary and that they don't have like a really big legacy at the time, that I feel like maybe their papers, their personal archive just kind of gets lost along the way, and like family members discard them or they're buried somewhere in a person's garage. And then you have like another case, like Anne Drysdale, who was a pastoralist on the Bellarine Peninsula. Most of her diaries are kept at the State Library of Victoria. There's one journal missing, which is odd. I'm not sure where that would have gone. Her partner, Caroline Newcomb, also kept a diary alongside Anne's, but Caroline's journals are missing. Mm. And the last person who would have had these diaries that historians would know of is her husband, who she married after Anne's death and who was a reverend and younger than Caroline. And he knew about Anne and Caroline's relationship, or at least like their friendship, because he wrote this really long obituary about Caroline after she died. And he would have been the one to authorize Caroline being buried alongside Anne, and also choosing to be buried with Anne and Caroline once he had passed away.
They were like a deceased throuple.
Exactly. Except Caroline's husband had never known Anne, which I find so curious. So when I think about where Caroline's diaries ended up, I just wonder like whether he, I'm not sure if he burnt them or anything or discarded them, but like where are they?
Yeah, it is conspicuous that they're missing.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, given all these challenges, you know, with finding evidence and archival material, which is obviously not just specific to your book, but endemic to queer history, were you ever tempted to actually just kind of write fiction? Like, I'm thinking, you know, of the recent work of amazing queer fiction Iris that we interviewed Fiona Kelly McGregor, the author, about that last season. And there's also Wifedom by Anna Funder as another kind of recent example of a merge of history and fiction. Did you think about going down that route?
I didn't at the time, but I feel like now I could definitely take one of these stories and write my own like fictionalized version. Yeah. I read Iris recently and loved it. I love how she used all of like the research and archives to construct that story. But it also seems like more effort in a way. I feel like it would take longer to write like a historical novel than it does a nonfiction book in a way. But it's interesting that you say that, because some of the stories in Pretty Friend have been told in creative ways. Like, there have been plays put on about Lesbia Harford, Anne Drysdale. There was recently like a musical about Lillian Cooper and Josephine Bedford, who were a couple in Queensland, and Lillian Cooper was Queensland's first female doctor. Josephine Bedford was an advocate for like children's well-being and was part of like the playground movement in Queensland. And they lived together most of their lives and are buried together. And I think it was like 2018 when it started. This queer playwriting couple wrote a musical about their experience in the First World War, because they traveled to Siberia. And this was when they were in like their 50s as well. They traveled to Siberia, and Lillian was a surgeon on the front line. Yeah, I just find it interesting that like the way that these stories have been often told through theatre and performance. So, yeah.
It struck me when you were talking before about the missing diary of Caroline and Annie, that seems like a perfect void to write fiction into.
That's very true, yeah.
And then I was also thinking, and so here leads to my next question. You use this beautiful line in the introduction of your book. There still seems to be a lingering concern with the not knowing, and so we dance around the fire of speculation, looking into its flames for any concrete clues that will let us write with absolute authority, this woman was a lesbian. We dance around the fire of speculation. I just love that phrase. So what I was wondering when you were telling that story before is that, could you speculate that Caroline's husband, the priest, the reverend, was possibly gay, and he knew everything about Caroline's life, and it was a marriage of convenience.
They wear each other's beards.
Yes.
Is that his expression?
Yeah.
I believe.
Catch up.
I believe told you I'm old.
It's called a lavender marriage, isn't it?
A lavender marriage, yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So could you speculate that he was gay and it was a lavender marriage? And then I suppose this is my next question. Is there a point to doing that? If it's speculation, if you can't know, is it just putting the questions out there that change people's minds and the way they think and that queer our history because suddenly we're not thinking straight about it? Or is there actually a necessity in some way to prove or disprove before you could go public with something like that?
I think if there was like a specific example of me writing a novelization of Caroline Newcomb's life and speculating her queer history, there's not necessarily a point for that, rather than my own enjoyment and potentially other people's enjoyment in reading that.
Yeah.
She's a very rich character, though. I think a novel could be made out of her life. To think about like whether there is a point to speculate on these histories and whether like they could be possibly written in a queer manner, then I think that there is some necessity towards it, because otherwise, without speculation for queer histories, it's so limited, and then you kind of don't really have any queer history, and like the queer history within Australia would just kind of be like, it would be a lot about the men's experience, because obviously homosexuality was criminalized from colonization into the late 20th century. So there's a lot of public records about men being arrested and that sort of thing. Whereas for women's histories, it's a lot harder because they were kind of living their lives very privately and wasn't as publicly known. And it's only really exceptional cases where they were publicly known or like it didn't end up in the newspaper. So I think there needs to be some sort of speculation or like an allowance for speculation, because without it, we don't have a lot of like groundwork. And then you're potentially losing all of this like queer history, or at least the possibility of a queer history, which means a lot for young readers and everything trying to find themselves within the archive and within like Australia's history and trying to think, well, is queerness or is transness just a new thing? As a lot of conservatives like to say, being gay is relatively modern and trendy, but people have been queer and trans for decades and centuries. So I think a queer and trans history are very important.
Yeah, these are questions I've thought about a lot as well, because, you know, like you, I'm an academically trained historian who's been kind of enculturated to be quite cautious about the knowledge claims we can make about the past, you know, particularly about retrospectively assigning identities like lesbian or queer or trans that didn't necessarily exist at the time. The conventional historian in me is a bit uncomfortable with that. But at the same time, like you, you know, I'm trans, but I am trans and I'm queer and work in trans advocacy and have a lot of friends in those communities. And I'm really conscious of that real hunger for a past, a sense of lineage and identity to belong with. When I'm thinking about these questions, I often feel kind of torn in two. Like there's the historian me and then the kind of queer advocate me who wants to do very different things. Like, did you experience that tension at all when working in this book?
Yeah, definitely. I think in the first year, especially when I was forming the thesis, because I was trying to still like thread it all together and make and trying to like work out what I wanted to do with my thesis. And because of the women I was writing about, particularly Anne and Caroline, who were living in like the 1840s, because you say like, oh, they were living in the 1840s. So it's so far away and you're just kind of like, well, queerness didn't exist in the 1840s, but obviously it did. But like whether it was relevant to these women, we don't know, and I still don't know. And I'm willing to be wrong, but I'm willing to say like, well, this is my interpretation of their relationship and whether it's right or wrong, but I'm not stating it as fact. Yeah, when I was writing my notes and kind of thinking about it, I was like, oh, what right do I have to write about these women in such a way? Like, would I be pissing off someone in the past for writing about them like this? And I think it was partly like imposter syndrome as well. Even now, like I don't like particularly think of myself as a historian. I think of myself as a writer, and I just happened to have written a book about history. So while I was writing the book, I was really nervous about how professional historians and academics would think of it and would read it, because it's not a very academic book, but it is about history. Partly it was just like imposter syndrome, and then partly it was that tension between like whether I could allow myself to write about people who may or may not have been queer. Yeah.
Yeah, but there is clearly at the same time this hunger for it. Like, you know, yeah. I know queer history is huge on TikTok. There's things like Rainbow History Class, yeah. who got a book deal out of their social media presence. So there's clearly a kind of younger generation of queers who really want that past. And your book is one of many products that's kind of feeding that hunger.
Yeah, and I think for me it was important to ground it in an Australian setting, because Australia does lack that history. And obviously there's confirmed queer historical figures who are like in Europe or in the United States, like really big names like Oscar Wilde and all of that. But I feel like it's different when you're kind of sharing the setting with someone in the past. You're reading about your own sort of hometown, but in a new way. So a lot of the women in my book lived in Melbourne. So I kind of felt closer to them in that capacity. And then there are women from Sydney or Hobart and Brisbane, and I wanted queer people in those cities to feel connected in some way to these stories as well.
Eve, that's an interesting way you framed it there too, about your own advocacy and the tension between training as a professional and then your inclinations as an advocate. And one of the things that I found reading your book, Danny, not so much the content, although, you know, clearly that is making an intervention, but there's a real activist tone that maybe you were able to take where a professional historian couldn't, that is almost kind of, well, fuck the archive.
Possibly. I don't know if I felt that way at the time, but yeah.
It's provocative in that way.
Provocative is a good word. I really respect the archive, though. I really love it. And I think archives are important to have this history. But I feel like one of my issues with archives is like how difficult they can be to access. Like, I'm not connected to any universities at the moment because I've graduated and I have a day job and I'm just kind of writing in my house. And so if I was trying to research again or undertake another historical project, I don't even know how I would do that.
I know where you're getting there. And I want to make the point that I don't feel like you are dismissing the archive, but there is just a tone. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. It's like a bit talking back to the archive.
Right.
Actually, we discussed that with Zoe Coombs-Marr in that interview in Queer Australia about talking back, which she literally did in the program of talking back to the archive.
Yeah, maybe this is just the nature of queer history, that you need to have a kind of skeptical, perhaps slightly combative relationship to the archive if you want to produce anything meaningful. Or maybe the problem is that the archives, they're colonial and they're patriarchal instruments, but they're also, you know, heteronormative institutions of knowledge, and they're organised around the presumption of heterosexuality. And to read queerness in the past, we need to be, you know, constantly challenging that, which puts us into an oppositional relationship with the archive. Now, unfortunately, Danny, we're going to have to start winding up. We're running out of time. But I wanted to end by asking you a question we ask all our guests here on Archive Fever. Do you have a dirty little archive secret you'd be willing to share with us?
I don't think I have anything particularly spicy, because when I was in the archive, I was like in my early 20s and I was so nervous and I wanted to follow all of the rules and not get kicked out of like Mitchell Library or anywhere. But there is a fun story about this image of Katie Lush, like the first confirmed photo of Katie Lush. And people listening to the podcast are probably like, who is Katie Lush? And you have to read the book to find out. But basically, she's one of the women I fixated on while I was at uni. I really wanted to find a photo of her because there were lots of like descriptions of how she was, like how she was tall and had auburn hair and everything. It was quite angular in appearance. But I wanted to find a photo. And when I was at the Mitchell Library looking through, it was Marjorie Pies's papers, because she researched Lesbia and Katie for the 1980s collection of Lesbia Harford's poems. I found this little scrap of paper and it had a photo of Lesbia with another woman. And on the back of it, it said, Lesbia with possibly Katie Lush. And then I got really excited because I was like, finally, it's a photo of Katie Lush. And I think it probably was Katie Lush, but of course it wasn't confirmed or anything. It was just like, it was a maybe. But then while I was writing the book, or after I'd written it and it was kind of going through edits, I got an email from an academic in Queensland. Her name is Rebecca Cheers, and she's undergoing a PhD and writing about Lesbia Harvard and Katie Lush. And she emailed me because she'd found a confirmed photo of Katie in Melbourne Library, in the State Library of Melbourne, in this random newspaper called The Southern Sphere. And yeah, it had a photo of Katie and it had her name, and I was like, oh my God. So I think, I feel like my fun little story is that the coolest thing I found in an archive wasn't found by me. But I sent the photo to my publisher and was like, oh, how cool is this? And they used that image as like inspiration for one of the women, the woman on the left of the book cover. So that's kind of inspired by the photo of Katie Lush.
She's hot.
Yeah. I think because she kind of looks quite theatrical in like this red dress. Mm. So
once you found the confirmed photo of Katie, were you able to go to the other one and match them and say that maybe Katie was a definite Katie?
Yeah, so I'm not very good with like facial recognition myself. I should try and find like a computer program, but they look very similar. They look very close. So I think it probably most likely was Katie in that photo that Marja Pizer found.
Yeah. Well, and that's also a story about, you know, solidarity among researchers
and the
importance of collaboration.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us, Dani. It's been an absolute pleasure.
To learn more about Dani's work, you can visit her website, daniellescrimshaw.com, or follow her on Instagram and Twitter at Dani_delivers.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright, or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve_Reese. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of the seasons 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5 via the website archivefeverpod.com. And you can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode. I mean, in general, the women in this book had been kind of forgotten. I sort of talk about them falling between the cracks of two national histories because they left Australia, but they weren't quite American either. But they were also better remembered in American popular memory and American institutions.